Okay, so let's go on to the next sutta. And this is Ajimanitaya number 19, two kinds of thoughts, Veda Vipakka Sutta in Pali. And very nice sutta in my opinion. This is the Buddha talking about his practice before his awakening. This is, to me, has always been one of those interesting things that the Buddha talks about his own practice before his awakening. Why does the Buddha do that? What is the purpose of talking about what he was doing? And I think the obvious reason why he does that is because he wants to inspire us, that he wants to explain us that this is what I did, you should practice in the same way, right? You should do exactly what I did. So he's basically trying to inspire us by giving us, saying, this is the path I practiced. But it is important in this situation to remember that the Buddha was a human being just like the rest of us. If the Buddha was not just like the rest of us, if the Buddha was some kind of God or some kind of special, if he is different from us, if he is not the same as we are, then of course his experience and his practice is not really applicable to us in the same way. It's only really applicable to us if the Buddha is human just like we are. If he had the same defilements, the same problems, the same kind of things that he was searching for as we have, and yet he was the same person, then his practice becomes applicable to us. It's very important to think about the Buddha in the right way. Yes, the Buddha was special. He was special in the sense that he was able to find the path, right? To find this without any teacher. That, of course, is already pretty awe-inspiring. We are trying to practice the path, right? We have got all the teachings, and still it is so hard sometimes. And he did it by himself. Wow, that's pretty amazing. So that already kind of puts the Buddha in a special position. But don't be careful not to elevate the Buddha too highly. If you elevate the Buddha too highly, then it becomes very difficult to relate to the Buddha's practice and to understand the Buddha in the terms of actually being a human being, pretty much just like us. And you find this, I will show this as we go through the sutta, because the sutta makes it fairly clear that is actually what is happening here. So keep this in mind, and then the sutta here becomes much more meaningful and powerful when you keep that in mind. So here we have starting the sutta from the very beginning. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, the laymen and the laywomen. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, etc. Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this, bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming or thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of compassion, if you like, on non-ruthlessness, which sounds pretty strange, but anyway, non-ruthlessness. So, here we have the Buddha living at Savati. How many people have you been to Savati? Yeah, quite a few, okay, great. Yeah, I've been there a few times myself, so Savati is quite nice. Quite nice that it's possible to go to this place in the present day. This was, of course, the place where the Buddha stayed the most, and where he would give most of his teachings. And then he says very interestingly here, because before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, right? So what does that mean? Bodhisattvas? I thought there wasn't any bodhisattvas in Theravada Buddhism. What's going on here? Where is this a kind of Mahayana intruding on the Theravada? What is happening here? And the answer is no, it's not Mahayana intruding at all. This is the Buddha talking about his prior to his awakening. He wasn't the Buddha yet, right? And what he called himself before his awakening, he called himself by this word, Bodhisattva. That was actually what he used to talk about himself. And in the suttas, the time that the Buddha was a Bodhisattva, most prominently, is after his leaving the home life until he became awakened, right? While he was searching for awakening, that was the time he was a Bodhisattva. So it doesn't really go back into past lives. It doesn't go back for incalculable and 100,000 eons or whatever it is. It doesn't do that. In the suttas, basically, it goes from the time that he went forth and decided to be a monastic. Now, there are certain suttas which also use the word Bodhisattva prior to that, and one of those is the Acharya Buddha Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya 123. And this is about all the wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha. And this is one of the few suttas where it says that the Buddha, or not the Buddha, he was a Bodhisattva even prior to that. And even while he was dwelling in a previous life, in the Tusitahara, he was already Bodhisattva according to that sutta. But that sutta is rather unique, it's rather special, it has a lot of elements that are late, and you can see that again by comparative study with the argument that I talked about before, and many late elements. So personally, I don't take the information that sutta as important as the later information, which basically is that he was a Bodhisattva at the time that he left the home life. So what does Bodhisattva mean? Normally, Bodhisattva is the Sanskrit term, Bodhisattva is the Pali term. What does it mean? Usually it's translated, usually it means like enlightenment being. Sattva or Satta usually means being, and Bodhi means awakening or enlightenment. Right? So while I was unawakened, awakening being. It's strange, right? I mean, it's strange when you think about it. It doesn't really come across as very natural. And I think that the meaning of this word, and this was something that was suggested by Professor Richard Gombrich a long time ago, is that this word actually doesn't mean that at all. It comes from a different Sanskrit root, which is not sattva, but sakta. And sakta means somebody who is intent on something, right? And so what it means then, but what I think it is quite likely to mean, impossible to say with certainty these things, but what I think it is likely to mean is that while I was still unawakened and intent on awakening, right? That is what I would take this word to mean. And then I think the meaning comes out much more nicely than this rather strange term awakening being, which to me doesn't really make all that much sense. So this is the first thing about the sutta, which is interesting. The one who is intent on awakening. And that, of course, only happens after you go forward from the home life into homelessness. That's when the Buddha himself was intent on awakening. So then it occurred to me, right? And the first thing is, I divide my thoughts into two classes. So what he's doing here is understanding that there are certain thoughts that should be grouped together. Thoughts of sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty, or harmfulness, or ruthlessness. And on the other side, the pure thoughts, which are thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, which includes metta, and thoughts of non-ruthlessness, which includes compassion. So this is already an interesting point in its own right, this ability, and this shows you that the Buddha already had developed a lot of understanding, because he was able to understand very clearly the distinction between wholesome and unwholesome. This is what this is all about, right? The unwholesome thoughts on the one side and the wholesome thoughts on the other side. And this is not as easy as you may think it is. Because these thoughts, as we saw in the previous sutta, the defilements can be very refined, right? But after very refined things, the desires that we have can often be about very subtle and minor things in life. The ill will can be also sometimes very, very subtle. If you haven't got full metta, it may mean that there's a little bit of ill will there, which is kind of stopping you from having the experience of metta. It's not really ill will that is active, it's more kind of this passive thing inside of you, which is blocking you from feeling compassion and metta to other beings. This is very refined things. And this shows that one of the things that we need to do on the Buddhist path is precisely to understand the distinction between the wholesome and the time also. And as you move along the path, that distinction will start to change. Right? When you start to develop your mind, you start to put away some of your bad habits, some of your, you know, whatever those habits may be, you put those away, other bad habits will surface underneath, right? The more refined bad habit. And then you have to look again and you have to say, oh, okay, well, these habits are coming now. And then you have to, again, divide them in and understand which ones are wholesome and which ones are unwholesome. And sometimes it is quite difficult to see these things. It's quite hard to actually take this all the way, because some of our attachments and things are so subtle and so refined and they're so attractive to us that they can be very difficult to give up. So it takes a lot of clarity to understand these things fully. And this is why on the Buddhist path, you find a lot of the Buddhist path is about contemplating your defilements, contemplating your mind and understanding the differences. This is what Satipatthana practice is about. When it comes to the Dhamma Nupassana, the understanding of Dhamma. So if you read that, as I was saying just before, a lot of that is about understanding the five hindrances. What, number one, what they are, because they are so refined. It is not obvious what they are. Well, sometimes it's very obvious, right? If you get really angry, you know exactly what's going on. But if it is very refined, it is not so obvious. So first of all, knowing what they are, knowing why they arise, knowing how that arising comes to an end, and knowing how they don't arise again in the future. So this is why this contemplation is so important, and why it is a fundamental part of Satipatthana practice. In fact, when you look at the overall idea of Satipatthana, what it is really about, you will see it is all about the juxtaposition. On the one hand, the impure mind state, on the other hand, the pure mind state. You have the Citta Nupassana, contemplation of the mind. It is all, if you don't understand what I'm saying, please just, you can allow to raise your hand and let me know, because maybe sometimes I use Pali terms or whatever without really thinking about it properly. But on the one hand, you have the Citta Nupassana, you have all the negative states of mind. Mind states which have desire, which have anger, or whatever. And on the other hand, we have all the pure mind states. The same thing with Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feeling, exactly the same thing. And the first Satipatthana, which is about the Kaya Nupassana, contemplation of the body, that too is about overcoming attachment and desire in regard to the body. So really, Satipatthana practice, one of the main purposes of Satipatthana is to help you to understand the distinction between defilements and non-defilements, how to overcome the defilements. And then you go to the Bodhangas, and if you look at the Bodhangas, Bodhangas are the awakening factors, right? Same thing again. First of all, you have the Satisampojjhanga, which is the awakening factor of mindfulness, which relates, which I've just been telling you, mindfulness is all about overcoming defilements, right? This is similar. And then you have the Dhammavicaya Sampojjhanga. Dhammavicaya Sampojjhanga is investigation of Dhammas, right? Very similar to the Dhamma Nupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta. Investigation of Dhammas is explained as understanding dark and bright states of mind. Dark is defilement, bright is non-defilement. Understanding mind that are blameworthy and non-blameworthy. Right? And again, about defiled states and undefiled states. So much of the Dhamma, so much of it is precisely about understanding defilements and non-defilements. Because this is the only way we can overcome them, by understanding what they are. And this is why this is emphasized so much. And this is why this is a very important teaching right here of the Buddha, this classification of the mind state into two different categories. It may seem kind of obvious when you read it, okay, you classify one this way, but actually, this is actually quite profound already. And that is why, in the very next sentence, oh, if I want time again, this is terrible. Anyway, there is a weird little thing, Bobby, in your agenda or your table here, because it says that this Sutta Session 3 is from 2 to 2:50, but the break only begins at 3. So between 2:50 and 3, it's like an empty, it's like a void. Sunyata between the two. I can do whatever I want, right? But I can take those 10 minutes and use them to my heart's desire. Anyway, I'm just going to stay very, very short. And that is why it is interesting that the Buddha then says, next thing he says is, as I abide in thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. That's the next thing he says, right? So, this is interesting because Well, first of all, let's get the translation a bit better. Diligent is apamada, right? Apamada really means more like being heedful. That's what it actually means. Heedful means being careful, right? Being circumspect, knowing, okay, is this bad, is this good, moving in the right direction. That's really what it means. Diligence to me is more like, you know, working very hard, you know, sitting at your desk, working long hours into the night or whatever. That's kind of diligent. So it means being heedful, careful, circumspect. Ardent, artapi, is really a synonym with being energetic. This means that we have energy. And resolute is closely connected to the four right efforts, to having effort. So the person who has effort, who is energetic, and who is heedful. Right? And that is what it means, to be heedful. That is what it means to be energetic. Is just that, the dividing of your thoughts into two different classes. Right? That's fascinating, because what it does not mean is using your willpower, kind of gritting your teeth. You know, I'm going to be kind, right? Or I'm going to force my mind into the right position so I can be kind. That is not what it is about. It's an aspect of wisdom to be heedful here, because it is wisdom that it enables you to divide your thinking mind or your mind into two aspects. It is not your willpower, it's your wisdom power. No? So it is wisdom here that is described as being heedful, being energetic, and being having effort. That is an aspect of wisdom. So again, just the point that I was making before, that wisdom has a very powerful part of the Buddhist practice. And much more so than you might think by just reading these things. So once you start to understand the implications, you start that is indeed the case. Okay, so now we haven't got any more time now. So I'm gonna stop at this point. So we'll see you back in 20 minutes. So please just stretch your legs or whatever, and then we'll continue afterwards.